Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and fastest growing segment of society. To those who have come to know, as I have, that the world's political, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are actually counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interests, to understand why they are doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't the least bit hateful. It's the most compassionate thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which permeates all of Yahweh's writings, because Torah means teaching, not law. And it introduces us to His liberating and empowering covenant. It provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number at any time over the next 3 hours is toll-free. It is 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin in Syria. We haven't talked about Syria the last few days other than in the second and third hour. Most recently, we have been addressing a prophecy that begins in Syria. But this news report from Reuters, reporting from the United Nations, I thought was peculiar enough to share with you. It reads, all sides in the Syrian civil war are using shelling and siege tactics to punish and starve civilians, and big powers bear responsibility for allowing such war crimes to persist, UN human rights investigators said on Wednesday. Let's be clear. It's not a civil war in Syria. It's a proxy war. They are remarkably different. For example, the war that has been called the Afghanistan Civil War was not a civil war. It was a proxy war. Proxy wars differ than civil wars. Another good example would be Vietnam. Vietnam was a proxy war, not a civil war. Now, there are some civil war aspects to a proxy war, and they very often take some shadings of civil war. But a proxy war is one where powers and influence outside of that country are mostly to blame for the fighting that is taking place. In the case of Syria, it's America's invasion of Iraq that gave Iraq to Iran that artificially increased Shiite Iranian influence throughout the Middle East that caused Turkey, Syria, Qatar, and other Sunni Islamic nations to feel threatened and therefore to arm both Syrian, Iraqi, and world Mujahideen jihadists so that they could oppose Shia Islam. It is being fought to rid the world of Shia Islam, not to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. And if you don't understand that background, there's no way to properly understand what is happening or what to do regarding Syria. For example, when you understand that it's a proxy war, not a civil war that is taking place here, you know that the world is to blame, but not in the way that the UN is specifying. The second aspect of this is interesting. It says that all sides are using shelling and siege tactics. Now, that is interesting in the sense that up to about a month ago, there had only been two sides. There were Sunni jihadists, and there were Assad, and Assad's forces were comprised of Hezbollah and his army. But now there are three sides in this battle, because the two largest Sunni Mujahideen, the al-Nusra Front and ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, have begun warring with one another. So now there are three sides in this war. But it does correctly reflect the fact that Each of them is willing to shell and use siege tactics to punish and starve civilians. They are terrorists after all. But keep in mind, Senator John McClown of Arizona, I just love a war, McClown, went on Fox News to belittle the world and say that that the jihadists weren't jihadists. Oh, yes, they were Muslims, but they're freedom-loving Muslims, if there was such a thing. And that they have been left to use light weapons, assault rifles, to deal with artillery tanks and aircraft. Well, you cannot shell using a Kalashnikov. You can't shell using an assault rifle. And the very fact that all sides are shelling tells you that the conclusion of the United States that Assad was the one that gassed his own citizens because only he had access to the primitive rocket launchers that that we have videos showing the rebels using. Well, that pretty much is torn asunder by all sides having the capacity to shell. Now, it says that the big powers bear responsibility for allowing such war crimes to persist. What does the UN want the world to do? How does the, the world is to blame because it is a proxy war and you have China and Russia providing weapons on one side in the United States and Europe through Saudi Arabia and Qatar providing weapons for the other side. And that is certainly perpetuating the problem. It is certainly exacerbating the problem. But how are the big powers, whatever they mean by big powers, I'm assuming they mean the United States and Russia, but how are the big powers to stop war crimes in Syria? How would they do so? Do you think the United States can dictate to the Mujahideen? Yeah, I can just see Obama telling the jihadists, now you ought not do that, and that they're going to listen to him? Can you imagine Putin getting Assad on the telephone and say, you know, I don't want you to be destructive now. You play nice. What in the world are they dreaming of? The independent investigators presenting their latest reports documenting atrocities in Syria called again on the UN Security Council to refer grave violations of the rules of war to the International Criminal Court for prosecution. Rules of war. I mean, these people have lost their mind. You know, there was a time when countries provided uniforms for the combatants. And that there was a distinction between military combatants and civilians. And in World War II, you can look at every country and see the number of civilians and military combatants that were maimed or killed. But you can't as it relates to Islam. Because in the case of Islam, very, very few of the combatants are military. Now, there are some in Syria because of Assad's army. But Assad was losing this battle until Hezbollah, which is a militia of civilians, engaged. And if you look at Iraq, yes, there are some police in Iraq and some army units in Iraq that are in uniform, thanks to America. No thanks to America. But the vast preponderance of the combatants in Iraq are civilians. In fact, when America invaded Iraq this second time, 100% of the casualties inflicted on Americans were perpetrated by civilians. So this is not the kind of thing that you can refer to as a war crime or a war tribunal. This is not nations fighting nations. This is not armies engaged in the rules of warfare. These are jihadists. These are terrorists. These are mujahideen. These are civilian militias that are going after one another. The Security Council bears responsibility, this quote says, for not addressing accountability and allowing the warring parties to violate these rules with impunity. So you think that a Mujahideen, the leader of al-Nusra Front, which, by the way, we don't even have a picture of. We think we may know a name, but we don't know if that's really his name. No one has, one person, I guess, has interviewed him, but there's really was no proof even then that he was who he said he was. And we don't even know what the command and control structure is, if there is a command and control structure of al-Nusra Front or of ISIS. And it's not that clean. It's not just that there are two gangs of jihadists trying to overthrow Assad and establish a Sunni caliphate in Syria. There are probably 100 different jihadi organizations there. And so who was going to talk to them? I mean, how would you even fathom the idea that that these folks are going to listen to the United Nations? I mean, these people are so full of their own hubris to think that the United Nations is somehow has an influence in what terrorists, jihadists, Islamic Mujahideen are going to do. These folks only listen to one source. One. And it's not the United States. It's not Russia. It's not Saudi Arabia. It's not Qatar. It's not Iran. It's not the Syrian government. It's not the United Nations. It's the Quran. That's all they listen to. And so unless you can rewrite the Quran that says that that this is how wars are to be fought, when Allah was pretty specific about how he wanted Muslims to fight, which is to use all manner of deception, which is to emphasize terrorism, which is to use every weapon available, which is to break treaties, which is to be so savage that no one would dare stand up to Islam and that all would submit. Unless you can erase all of those statements in the Quran and replace them with the United Nations rules on war, welcome back to Shattering Myths. This article goes on to say, and it's reporting directly from the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into Syria, and it reads that the Security Council bears responsibility for not addressing accountability and allowing the warring parties to violate these rules with total impunity. Now, the Security Council has absolutely no influence on the Mujahideen. So on the 100 or so terrorist organizations that are trying to establish Sharia law and reestablish the caliphate in Syria, they do not have a representative on the in the United Nations, much less on the Security Council, and they would never consider anything that an infidel organization had to say. So that side, or sides, if you view the Mujahideen as being irreparably at war with one another, cannot be influenced by the Security Council. As it relates to Assad, you have to break Assad down, his forces down into to two groups. And just to speak of Assad as if he's just the lone boogeyman would be stupid. Because the most effective fighting force in Syria against the Sunni Mujahideen isn't Saddam's army. It is, in fact, Hezbollah. And Hezbollah does not report to Bashar al-Assad. Hezbollah reports to the Grand Ayatollah in Tehran. And as a Islamic terrorist organization, they're fundamentalist Muslims. They're going to get their marching orders from the same Quran. They are not going to listen to a secular organization, which leaves you only with Assad. And if Assad's fighting for his very survival, he isn't going to pay any attention to anybody else. So this is just so full of hubris that those in the United Nations think they are so important and that their rules prevail. It's kind of like the United States, where socialist secular humanism and political correctness has become the national religion, and you can practice any religion you want so long as it doesn't in any way, shape, or form conflict with the imposition of political correctness and socialist secular humanism. Well, the same thing is with the United Nations. They think that they are the de facto dictator of morality in the world. They even have a morality for fighting wars, as if the participants in this conflict could give two hoots about them. Quote, one of the stark trends we have documented is the use of siege warfare, the denial of humanitarian aid. Food and basic necessities such as medical care and clean water have forced people to choose between surrender and starvation. That's the purpose. I mean, that is the only way that Muslims know how to fight. Muslims do not have the capacity to fight any other way. And nations that do have the capacity typically choose this route. It's how the North won the what's called the American Civil War. It's how the United States ultimately prevailed over Germany and Japan in the Second World War. We bombed cities, civilian targets, into oblivion. We eliminated their access to humanitarian aid, to basic necessities, to medical care, to clean water, to shelter. It is even nations that have the capacity to fight in a different way and just engage between military combatants choose this approach. And Muslims don't have the capacity to fight in a stand-up battle between military units. So it's all they know how to do. It's what they have always done. More than 140,000 have been killed in the conflict, which enters its fourth year next week. 2.5 million refugees have fled abroad, and 6.5 million people are uprooted within Syria. Yes, it is a massive war. And according to what Yahweh has to say, this war is going to be fought for some time. There is no resolution. There is no way to throttle it down. It is going to continue. I think it's going to continue for a decade. And when it's over, as we will learn in our second hour, Damascus will be a heap of tangled ruins. The Syrian government is going to fall. The Sunni jihadists, therefore, are going to be victorious, but not in the sense that they conquer Syria, but in the sense that they destroy it. And then what happens from there is more egregious still. So we will return to Shattering Myths. I have a report on the Roman Catholic Church, followed by another interesting series of reports on Crimea, the Ukraine, the United States, and the belligerents in that conflict. We'll be back with Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Come back to Shattering Myths. Yesterday, I criticized Hillary Rodham Clinton for making a comparison between Crimea and Czechoslovakia as it relates to her speech in Long Beach, where she compared Putin to Adolf Hitler, and made it quite clear that to compare the two is ludicrous. Crimea has been part of Russia for many hundreds of years. It has only been separated from Russia for 20 years. And in the case of Czechoslovakia, it was not part of Germany. And Czechoslovakia was given to Germany by England, where there just is no parallel between the two. And when politicians resort to talking about other politicians and equating them to Adolf Hitler, then they're just opening themselves up to disgrace. And that's what happened with Hillary Clinton. Today in the news, I'm not the only person who has criticized her for the stupidity of her comment. And she's being rebuked from here to there and all over for it. One of the problems here is that Americans and much of the world has been dumbed down to the point that we have to personify every foe. And so Crimea isn't about the Crimeans, it's about Putin from the American perspective. And so if Clinton can present Putin as being like Hitler, then we have a boogeyman that we should oppose, as opposed to a rational human that is trying to deal with an extremely complex issue. And we just take snapshots in time, take things out of context to present all manner of hideousness to slather on the individual. We did it with Saddam Hussein. Not a good guy. But what was said about Saddam Hussein to justify the invasion was grotesquely misleading. And so that's what she's doing. And so she's playing to a stupid electorate, using rhetoric that is incredibly inflammatory and does no one any good, destroying her own credibility in the process. Now, speaking of credibility, remember about a month ago we did a series on way that the Vatican failed to respond to and actually rebuked the United Nations for the Roman Catholic Church's ongoing failures related not only to priestly pedophilia, but the cover-up of priestly pedophilia, moving pedophilic priests around so they could abuse more children. At the same time, there was a lead story that came out of Chicago where the Chicago case against the Roman Catholic Church not only showed that priests had abused scores of young children, but that the Roman Catholic Church in America had specifically aided and abetted the abuse of the children as opposed to defending them. Well, there's a story that came out yesterday that says at that same time there was another ruling. Didn't make the headlines, however. And that ruling was in a Missouri Supreme Court. I guess Missouri is so buried in the South that it doesn't have journalists. But guess what? The Missouri Supreme Court ruled that the Archdiocese of St. Louis must reveal the names of the priests accused of sexually abusing minors. They lost another case. It's pervasive around this country, throughout Europe, throughout South America, in the South Pacific. It's around the world. The disease is Roman Catholicism. It will kill you. There's an article yesterday. Senator John McCloud from Arizona was having a conniption fit. Let me share with you a little bit about this article because it underscores the problem that we have in the United States. It was headlined, "Was the United States Caught Off Guard?" There are serious questions whether the U.S. intelligence failed to predict what is happening on the ground in the Ukraine. In a tense hearing on Capitol Hill Wednesday, Senator John McCain hammered Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, asking him whether U.S. intelligence was aware of Russia's plans to invade Crimea. Now, by the way, there really is no indication at this point that Russia has invaded Crimea. They have a base there. They have troops there. But it appears that those who are acting in Crimea are Crimeans. In fact, the Parliament of the Autonomous Region of Crimea today voted to reestablish their relationship with Russia, to become part of Russia. What they did is no different than what happened in Kiev. In Kiev, the people didn't vote. The elected official was deposed by the Parliament, not the people. There was no democratic action here. The parliament voted out the popularly elected leader and voted themselves in power. Well, the parliament in Crimea, an autonomous region, did exactly the same thing, but with the opposite result. They said, we don't agree with what took place in Kiev, and as Crimeans, we wish to reestablish ourselves as part of Russia. And so if we're going to honor the vote of Parliament in Kiev, why would we not honor the vote of Parliament in Crimea? And in that case, where's the invasion, folks? More important, as we go through this particular McCain tizzy fit, immediately upon the issues and the protest in the Ukraine, we investigated the history of the Ukraine. I told you about the Orange Revolution that had taken place. I told you about the bankruptcy in the Ukraine. I told you about their pogroms and their history, and revealed how it was a really a mob scene, gang mentality in Kiev, which was very consistent with these people's past behavior. And then we took time to look at the ethnic diversity of the Ukraine and figured out that the area around Kiev is mostly ethnic Ukrainians, but if you move to the eastern part of the Ukraine and the southern part of the Ukraine, you get to a percentage of about 40% Russians. And in Crimea, it's about 70% Russians. So we said, you know, it's likely that Russia will protect its interests, because we also investigated the history of the Ukraine and found out, with the exception of the last 20 years, for hundreds of years, the Ukraine has been part of Russia. It's much more part of Russia than Texas is part of the United States. And we were able to identify the issues, which are that Russia has a massive pipeline that runs through the Ukraine. It provides most of the natural gas for Eastern European countries and the Balkans, and 30% of the natural gas for Europe at large. They aren't going to allow a hostile government to in any way thwart the flow through that pipeline. They're going to protect it. They're not going to allow the large population of Russians in the eastern Ukraine and the southern Ukraine to be subjected to the gang mentality that is on display in Kiev. And they have anarchy on their border. This is a country that has failed miserably in its attempts to be independent. And so we talked about all of those things, and we predicted what was going to happen, because it's so logical. It's so easy to understand how the various players are going to move. And yet the United States, spending hundreds of billions of dollars spying on everybody in the world, couldn't figure it out. It goes back, my friends, to this dichotomy. There is this misconception that knowledge makes a person smart. And I dare say that those who are engaged in U.S. spying know a lot of things. They don't understand anything. And understanding is vastly more empowering than is knowledge. Now, knowledge can sometimes lead to understanding, and it's hard to understand without some knowledge. But ultimately, understanding is vastly more important than knowledge, and that is what we lack. And we lack it because we do not exercise good judgment. Because this country has become a cesspool for political correctness, for that new moral code that discourages judgment. So here is the argument between Hegel and John McCain. McCain, so, despite all the media reports, our intelligence sources predicted that Lavrov would invade Crimea. Hegel, as I said, I don't want to get into specifics in an open hearing, but you would like to brief in your staff on the specifics of your question. Boy, Hegel can't talk. I read that exactly as it was written. In other words, Hegel saying, I'm not going to talk to you publicly. Yeah, you know, America is now just a land of nothing but secrets. McCain will. How about commenting on the news reports that say this? It has become obvious today, as misinformed as the media is, that the media provides a better picture of what's happening in the world than does U.S. intelligence. Hegel, well, news reports are news reports, but that's not the same as real It's not real intelligence, though. There's this sense that America's intelligence is real when it hasn't been real in a very, very long time. They're clueless. All of the NSA's efforts haven't thwarted a single terrorist attack, not one. The CIA has done far more harm than good. Military intelligence is an oxymoron. McCain, okay. In other words, the fact is, Mr. Secretary, it was not predicted by our intelligence, and that's already been well known, which is another massive failure because of our misreading, total misreading of the intentions of Vladimir Putin. Vilifying a single man, making a single individual into a boogeyman, and then pretending that our intelligence is that, is going to lead a lot of people astray. We're a nation of lost souls. It's amazing that we just are blind to what's happening in Crimea. Reuters is reporting, hold up in their bases. Ukraine's besieged servicemen and Russians surrounding them in Crimea are locked in a standoff that at times is tense and at others is surreal. Now, if you look at the uniforms of those who are reported to be Russians, they may be Russians by ethnicity, but Crimea was an autonomous region. They're Crimeans. Putin has declared this. The pictures are obvious. Why is it that we can't pick up that? Or is it just that we're just so myopic that we can only see it if it's a boogeyman? Almost a week, the report says, after Russian forces began their swift and bloodless takeover of the Ukrainian Black Sea Peninsula. It's not the Ukrainian peninsula. It's the Crimean Peninsula. And it's an autonomous region. And Russian forces didn't begin their swift and bloodless takeover. They were always in control. And it's indigenous Crimeans that began to immediately say, what happened in Kiev, we don't support. We're not going along with that program. The Russians have swatted down isolated attempts by the Ukrainian forces to claw back in control, but stop short of using major force. There has been no big clash and no deaths. But no clash. And it's just, we are completely misrepresenting the facts. Anyway, here's the report that, as I mentioned to you earlier in the program, it comes from Crimea. And I want to tell you that I had to dig to find this. And I have 20 of the world's leading news feeds on my homepage. I use a proto page for those who are interested. And I have a proto page account called Shattering Myths. And on it, I've got 20 of the world's largest news feeds. And each of them present eight of their top eight stories. And it includes Reuters, The Washington Post, the BBC, Fox News, the International Tribune, CNN, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, goes on and on. Largest news gathering agencies in the world. None of them even had the story that I'm going to share with you. This was buried under Yahoo. It reads, Crimea's parliament voted to join Russia on Thursday, that's today, and its Moscow-backed government set a referendum on the decision in 10 days' time and a dramatic escalation in the crisis over the Ukrainian Black Sea Peninsula. You know, why not call it what it is? It's the Crimean Peninsula. It's been the Crimean Peninsula for centuries. And those in the Crimean Peninsula, an autonomous region, have a parliament. That's what you have if you're in a autonomous region. And they voted to rejoin Russia. Why not just state it that way? Why doesn't everyone say it that way? Or are we afraid to say it that way because it won't sound patriotic, because it makes our government look foolish? Why is it that we would wallow all over ourselves and provide $1 billion and risk exacerbating Russia and this relationship to the point that we start a world war because a few thousand belligerents in Kiev shooed the popularly elected leader out of town in a coup, and that parliament voted themselves a new leader. Well, they did exactly the same thing in the Crimean Peninsula. Why would you honor one and say the other is illegitimate? The sudden acceleration of moves to bring Crimea, which has an ethnic Russian majority, about 70%, has effectively been seized by Russian and has effectively been seized by Russian forces, which is not true. Formerly under Moscow's rule, came as European Union leaders held an emergency summit, groping for ways to pressure Russia back down and accept mediation. Mediation for what? The people have voted. That's what they want. Why not honor it? Why not view the Ukraine as it has been for hundreds of years as part of Russia? It has completely failed in its attempts to be independent. The Ukraine and the world, all of the Ukraine and the world, are better off if they're reincorporated back into Russia. They will be nothing but a parasite on the West. We cannot afford them. The first play in this game is $35 billion, which will be squandered in a year. Why can't we think our way through this?